Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Alberta Ingenuity recently brought together experts from across North America to address watersheds and our concerns over water shortages and crises in water quality. Climate change, drought, overallocation, and misplaced priorities were all topics of discussion at the Conference on Watersheds. Dr. Henry Vox Jr. from the University of California looked at the global economics of trading water embedded in food exports. Dr. David Sochin from the University of Regina placed the recent prairie drought and climate change within the context of our historical records. And Dr. David Schindler from the University of Alberta presented new findings on the ecological consequences of water shortages and trophic disturbance. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Water is our lifeblood, both biologically and economically. The United Nations has declared this year as the year of fresh water. And as the world's economy becomes more globalized and interconnected, water shortages in other parts of the world will be felt more and more in North America. Speaking at the recent Alberta Ingenuity Conference on Watersheds in Calgary was Dr. Henry Vox Jr., an associate vice president of the University of California system and a professor of economics at the university's Berkeley campus. Henry Vox Jr. has devoted his career to the study of the economics of water resources, be it the water running in a stream or the virtual water we export, a term he calls embedded water.
Well, we talk about water being embedded or embodied in food in that it takes a certain amount of water to grow a given food crop. Countries that are short of water, that is, countries that have less than 1,500 cubic meters of water per capita per year, have to import food because they simply do not have enough water locally to grow all of their own food. So they supplement the food that they do grow with food that's imported. Imported food takes water to grow, so that the effect of importing the food is to import the water that it took to grow that food, which is in effect embedded in the food. So for example, if you import a kilogram of wheat, that kilogram of wheat required approximately 500 liters of water to grow. That means that you, when you import the kilogram, have been endowed with 500 liters of water that you didn't have otherwise. If you hadn't imported the wheat, you would have had to spend 500 liters of water to grow it, and with countries that are water short, they may not have that water to spend.
Which are those countries, and what can we expect in the future?
The countries that are water short today are largely found in North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunis, Libya, Egypt, some on the Horn of Africa, South Africa, and then the countries of the Middle East. By the year 2025, we expect Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, and India to be added to that list, and perhaps China. That's a very conservative estimate. There could be even more countries added to that list. But what that suggests to us is that there's going to have to be a lot more food exported from countries like Canada in order to meet the food demands of a growing population and countries that simply don't have enough water to grow the food needed to feed the increases in population.
What does this mean then for countries like Canada, which now we're looking at water problems of our own, in being able to continue to supply a growing number of countries that are looking at greater importation of food?
Well, Canadians, just like any other North Americans, are going to have to sit down and decide for themselves how they wish to balance their scarce water resources among the various uses for it, be they agricultural uses, environmental uses, or urban uses. Canadians and Albertans will have to arrive at that decision, and I think that my What I have attempted to contribute is to make Albertans aware that they are likely to have a much more significant niche or a much more significant place in the globalizing economy two decades hence because of the ability to grow cereal grains and other agricultural crops here on the Albertan prairie. And I think it's up to Albertans to decide what it is they want to do. But I do think that as they make that decision, they ought to be well informed about what kinds of forces and pressures are going to be about in two decades hence. And I think there is a possibility for Alberta to play a major role in a globalizing agricultural economy. And I've not heard anyone talk about that before.
You referred to agriculture as being the water source of last resort. What did you mean by that?
Well, in most places in the West, including, I think, Alberta, water is already fully allocated. In other words, there isn't any surplus water to go around when one counts the environmental uses of water. Historically, I think we, although we didn't understand it this way, environmental uses of water were always the supplier of last resort, in that when we needed to develop new water for irrigation or new water to support growth in the cities, we simply took water that was in the stream there that was doing environmental things and used that. Well, with our understanding now of the value of environmental services and from aquatic ecosystems, I think most people believe that we need more, not less, water for the environment. We also need more water for growing urban areas in Alberta and elsewhere in Western North America. And agricultural water users use such a large amount of water. 75% of the consumptive use of water in the South Saskatchewan Basin is for irrigation purposes, that it seems, and I ought to add, some of those purposes are quite low valued. Given that, it seems to many people that the easiest way to solve our current water problems is to reallocate some agricultural water to serve the growing urban demands as well as environmental demands. What my analysis suggests is that one can't simply count on that agricultural water always being so easily available in a world where there are many more people and many of them are not able to grow their own food.
One of the concerns in Canada is that eventually the Americans are going to suck us dry as far as water goes. Do you think that's going to happen?
No, I think that's nonsense. I think that Americans who believe that they're going to ship water from the Fraser River or the Yukon or wherever down to the lower 48 are terribly misguided. I also think that in the event that somebody mounted a campaign to do that, Canadians would be pretty well equipped to fight it off. My own view of this is that solving one's water problems by importing water from other areas misses the point. The point is that we've got to learn to live with our own indigenous supplies. We're taught when we grow up that we're supposed to live within our means fiscally. We need to live within our means hydrologically as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Henry Vaux, Jr., an associate vice president of the University of California system and a professor of economics at the University of California's Berkeley campus. The Canadian prairies constantly cycle through periods of drought and rain, but climate warming is disrupting that cycle, and the loss of mountain snow cover that normally recharges our rivers is contributing to a prolonged period of drought. Dr. David Sochin is with the Prairie Adaptation Research Collaborative, or PARC, at the University of Regina. At the Alberta Ingenuity Conference on Watersheds, he brought an historical perspective to the discussion on water shortages.
Our research focuses on how the climate has changed in the past in the prairies and how we expect it to change in the future, and especially what that means in terms of how it's going to impact the prairie economy and different sectors of the economy and how those different sectors will adapt to the changing climate.
What would you say our climate is right now?
Well, there's already been significant climate change. The weather records of the past several decades show that the climate has already begun to change in the way that's forecast by the global climate models.
How do we compare to, say, 150 or even 1,000 years ago?
There has been considerable warming over the last 150 years, beginning with the Industrial Revolution and the use of fossil fuels and the combustion of greenhouse gases. In terms of the past 1,000 years, the 20th century was relatively benign. That is, what I mean by that is there wasn't a lot of extreme weather events in the 20th century until relatively recently. And we know that from scientists who have looked at the archives of climate that exist in lakes and trees and in soils and sediments. And it shows that the 20th century had some bad years, but there weren't extended droughts or serious climate hazards like there were in the past.
You showed in one of your slides comments from some of the earlier explorers and even comments that showed that there was no water running through the North Saskatchewan River.
Mm-hmm, that's right. In the archives of the Hudson Bay Company, we found records of Fort Edmonton where the fur traders had difficulty moving the furs at Fort Edmonton in the 1790s because of what they said was a want of water in the North Saskatchewan River. There wasn't enough water to support a canoe. And that observation corresponds with records that we have from trees in the Cypress Hills that show that there was a serious drought in the latter part of the 1700s.
Now that we're heading into 2000 and beyond, what should we be doing? How should we be concerned about water and climate and how the two come together?
We should be concerned that the global climate models indicate that we expect the prairies to become increasingly drier. As the climate warms, more water is lost by evaporation and plants give off more water. So the best scientific evidence indicates that there will be a gradual drying out of the prairies. But also these same models indicate that droughts will be of a greater severity, and at the same time there may be more extreme events where there's an excess of water. So there is this shift in climate that's forecast, and as government agencies and industry, and that we should begin to think in terms of how we will adapt or adjust to this changed climate so that there won't be suffering and cost associated with the warmer climate.
What do you mean by adapt? Give me some examples.
Adaptation, by definition, is an adjustment to just about everything we do. So the way we use soil and water and vegetation, the land management practices, the engineering infrastructure, just about every aspect of our lives can be adjusted to, usually to just a small extent, so that the cost of climate change is minimized. Really, adaptation is making small adjustments.
What research is your organization, PARC, looking at now?
Currently, we have a major project where we have, in collaboration with the Climate Change Action Fund of Natural Resources Canada, we have funded research on the impact of climate change on water supplies in the South Saskatchewan River Basin of Alberta and Saskatchewan. And in addition to just the modeling of water supplies, a key part of this major research project is examining the vulnerability of the water users in the basin to the forecasted change in water supplies.
If we look ahead 50, 80, 100 years, who's going to be the hardest hit?
Well, the hardest hit will be those sectors or groups that fail to adapt. It's difficult to anticipate now who might be the hardest hit. Certainly, water scarcity or water deficits are going to be a problem. So those industries and groups that depend on a reliable water supply are going to be impacted. But there is quite a bit that can be done in terms of making adjustments starting now to minimize the impact and the cost of lesser water supplies.
In terms of geography, though?
In terms of geography, well, on a global scale, it's fairly clear that the greatest amount of global warming is expected to occur at the highest latitudes, so in the Arctic, but also in the middle of the continents, because the oceans have a moderating effect on the climate. The oceans tend to buffer climate extremes, which is why along the coasts of Canada, the climate especially the temperature, doesn't shift from season to season like it does on the prairies. For the same reason, given the lack of large bodies of water, we expect the largest amount of warming to occur in the center of the continent.
So that would be?
Center of North America is the southern part of the Canadian prairies and the northern part of the U.S. plains.
You've given a presentation today to a conference that is looking at watersheds and their importance in our lives. What does that mean to you? What's the significance of something like this?
In terms of the significance of the conference, it's very good timing because water is the central issue in terms of the immediate future of the Prairie Provinces and the impacts of climate change. In previous decades, the forecasts were that dwindling energy reserves would limit economic development, but it's clear now that it's going to be a scarcity of water or water deficit that may limit economic development more so than a source of energy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. David Sochin, a scientist working with the Prairie Adaptation Research Collaborative at the University of Regina. Dr. David Schindler is known around the world for his superb research on water and water ecology. He's a winner of the Stockholm Water Prize, recipient of the Hertzberg Gold Medal from NSERC, a fellow in the Royal Society of London, and the Killam Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. His keynote address set the stage for discussions at the Alberta Ingenuity Conference on watersheds, and every presenter made some reference to Dr. Schindler's observations and findings. He notes that Alberta is now into 5 straight years of drought, the longest dry period since we've started keeping instrumental records. I asked him if it's going to get any better.
That's what's really hard to predict. Of course, these flip-flops between wet periods and dry periods have been going on for a long time, as Dave Sochin showed. And what flips them and how long a dry period or a wet period will last is hard to predict. But what is clear is that the dry periods in the past have generally exceeded the wet periods, at least for all but the 20th century. And if you add that to the fact that we're seeing climate warming, which is causing more water to evaporate, and we're having more and more people, Alberta's in the midst of a population explosion, and most of those people need industry or agriculture as a livelihood, which are water-consuming things. When you put all of those together, I think it's not a very pretty picture.
What should we be doing? Is there anything we can do?
There's a lot that we can do. People tend to turn to engineering solutions, dams and diversions and reservoirs, but that wouldn't be my solution. I think the first thing we need is a very strong water conservation program. Everything from conserving water in our cities to encouraging agriculture that uses low amounts of water, whether it be livestock or irrigation. Most of the agricultural activities that I see are still not very water efficient. And to just make better use of the water that we have, strategies to grow crops that demand less water rather than more is another way that we could be doing things. I think it eventually, though, we are already so far into climate warming with so little sign that anyone is going to do anything significant about greenhouse gases, we're going to have to consider limiting the population, at least in some parts of Alberta, and the amount of livestock that we can have on the landscape and the sorts of crops that can be grown. I think it's inevitable.
What is your research over the last year telling you?
Well, our most recent research has been on lakes in central Alberta. We've got an intensive project on Lac La Biche with some satellite projects on other lakes in the area. And what we've seen is, firstly, declines in lake levels and in the rates at which lakes are flushed with new water. But coupled with that, we've seen increased nutrient concentrations and increased algal blooms, partly as a result of less dilution of the nutrients with water flushing, and partly because of land use changes. Just changing forested landscapes to pastures or agriculture increases the nutrients that run off the land by at least a factor of two, and it can be a factor of 5 or 10. So we're seeing what we call the eutrophication or the over-fertilization of lakes with all of the consequences for bad water quality. And it's clear that there are a number of contributors, the land use change being an important one, climate being important via its effect on water, evaporating more water so that there's less to flow through lakes and maintain lake levels, but also changes to the structure of the lake communities caused by excessive removal of predatory fish species. Ecosystems are set up in a strange and very predictable way. In aquatic systems, and for that matter a lot of marine and terrestrial systems, well, the ecosystem properties depend on the number of trophic levels. For example, in lakes, if there are 4 trophic levels, algae as the photosynthesizers, a herbivore, in this case usually a big crustacean like Daphnia, and then small fish that eat the crustaceans, and finally big fish that eat the small fish, that's a typical northern food chain. And under normal conditions, the predatory fish keep the populations of minnows down. As a result, there are a lot of the grazing crustaceans, and they keep the algal populations low. So it's a low algal phase. If you remove the top predators, which is what we do when we fish, we always fish for the predatory fish, then the next trophic level doesn't have predators, and it's released, and as a result, it overgrazes the crustaceans so that the filtering power of the crustaceans is diminished. There are a lot more algae around, so he's flipped to a high algal stage. And as you continue on down, if you were to remove the minnow phase, you'd flip back to a low algal phase because the predators on the zooplankton are gone so that they can flourish again.
How does that relate, though, to whether or not it's drying up, or does it have any relation to that?
Well, it combines with the drying up to create the effect that we see on water quality. There are actually a number of contributing factors. One is the less flushing that I mentioned as a result of climate warming. A second is higher nutrient inputs, which cause more algal growth as a result typically of land use change, though in a few cases it can still be urban sewage where we haven't controlled that well. And the third thing is these changes to aquatic communities where we flip them from a low algal phase to a high algal phase by fishing out the predators. And all three things act in concert. There's actually a fourth thing, too. And that's the supply of silica. There isn't any silica in precipitation. It all comes with river flows and stream runoff because it's weathered out of the soils and rocks. The normal algae that dominate these lakes early in the season are called diatoms, and they're algae that, while they photosynthesize, literally live in little glass cases. They're pure silica, very intricate shapes that identify the different species. And when the algae die, the silica cases are bombed into the sediments, and they're gone. So to grow diatoms, you need new silica supplies. Well, as the water flows decline, the silica declines as well. So that earlier and earlier in the summer each year, the diatoms that normally flourish are running out of silica. Once they can't build their little glass frustules, as they're called, they have to give way to another form of algae. And in Alberta, where we normally have very low ratios of nitrogen to phosphorus under even normal conditions, and that's exaggerated even more by agricultural or urban runoff, The typical algae that replace them are blue-green algae, because blue-green algae can draw nitrogen from the atmosphere, which no other forms can. And they float on the surface and cause the unsightly scums that people complain about.
And they're also very toxic, too, aren't they?
They can be. Some species, like Microcystis, produce algal toxins that can cause liver damage in extremely high concentrations. Or they can cause taste and odor problems so that people don't like to drink the water. And they're poor food for any of the organisms in the food chain that I described. They're too big and in some cases too gelatinous to be filtered effectively by the crustaceans, so that they tend to accumulate floating around on the surface and eventually in windrows along the shore, not being effective at all in promoting the growth of fish, and yet causing all these nuisance problems. And they're a pretty typical sign of what we call eutrophication again, and they're a sign that people really object to.
Is there anybody in the world that's doing something right about water that we could use as an example?
That's a really good question. I think overall, probably the people who are doing best with water are the Australians. And I think the reason is that they recognized right from the start that they didn't have much water to deal with. So, for example, the bigger Australian cities tend to protect the whole watershed that supplies their drinking water. And they live in a hot climate that promotes the growth of these blue-green algae to begin with. So they also have excellent filtration and treatment facilities. It's remarkable that for a water-poor country, you very seldom hear about the sort of waterborne illnesses that we were hearing about from Canada and the U.S. this afternoon. So probably in terms of balanced management and treatment, they do the best.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. David Schindler, the Killam Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. He was the keynote speaker at the recent Alberta Ingenuity Conference on Watersheds, which was held in Calgary. I also spoke with Dr. David Sachin and Dr. Henry Vox, Jr. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the University of Lethbridge, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Conservation Association, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.